The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the New York Times. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Today on Armchair Traveler, we begin our journey by searching for the real thing on the North Carolina barbecue trail. Writer Ingrid K. Williams reveals what she learned on a rural road trip in the eastern part of the state, where she explored the food and culture of old school tradition. Now, her article appeared in the July 2nd, 2025 issue of the New York Times. And for you seasoned barbecue lovers, you may find a new spot to check out or maybe gain more insight into one of North Carolina's most delectable treasures. Let us begin. Okay. On the outskirts of Greenville, North Carolina, thick smoke billowed from the pit beside Bee's Barbecue, a squat storefront on the corner of North Carolina Highway 43 and Bee's Barbecue Road. It was just past 6:30 a.m. on a Saturday, and the sun was rising as I parked beneath an oak tree where two of the three sisters who run the place, which was opened by their parents in the 1970s, were carrying potatoes from a shed. I'd heard that if you wanted off-menu ribs, you had to come early. They'd be sold out by the time Bee's opened around 9 a.m. "Morning," I called. "Any chance of getting some ribs?" "Half rack or full?" asked Tammy Godley, the middle sister. "There's no phone to call and order at Bee's, but there's a list inside, and my name was on it now." Many visitors to this part of North Carolina, about 80 miles east of Raleigh, zip past the rural farmland and small towns en route to the Outer Banks beaches. But I'd stopped in Greenville, a lively college town beside the Tar River, in pursuit of the increasingly rare old-school establishments that still cook barbecue the way it's been made here for centuries. Whole hogs smoked low and slow over wood, served in a peppery vinegar-based sauce. This particular type of barbecue, known as Eastern North Carolina style, was what I scoured the region for over the next couple of days, nearly eating my weight in pulled pork, coleslaw, and hush puppies along the way. Wood smoked and heavy on the vinegar. As someone who grew up in a state where barbecue was something you did with hot dogs and hamburgers on a backyard grill, my first taste of wood-smoked, hand-chopped pork was a revelation. 20 years ago, when I moved to Durham, North Carolina, smack dab between the state's two barbecue regions, most locals had a preference for either the Eastern style or the Western Piedmont style, also called Lexington style, where pork shoulders replace whole hogs and there's ketchup in the vinegar sauce. I pledge my allegiance to the East. The barbecue that's served in eastern North Carolina today is probably the closest thing you'll find to the way barbecue was done in the 19th century, and even back into the colonial era, said Robert F. Moss, the contributing barbecue editor at Southern Living magazine and author of Barbecue, the History of an American Institution. In recent years, a new crop of barbecue restaurants has opened across the Research Triangle, which also includes Raleigh and Chapel Hill, blurring the long-standing regional lines. Most serve some version of North Carolina-style barbecue alongside Texas-style beef brisket, Kansas City-style ribs, smoked turkey, chicken, and sausages, with a mix-and-match array of sauces. Now, there was none of that at the humble old-school joints I visited on my trip, and just to give you some examples, she had a list here. At Skylight M Barbecue in Aiden, North Carolina, they had a vast pile of Carolina oak used to smoke meat, and at Prime Barbecue in Knightdale, Longleaf Swine in Raleigh, and Picnic in Durham, all casual yet polished restaurants, you can have a local craft beer with your pulled pork sandwich, and at the Pit in Raleigh, there's a wine list, signature cocktails, and valet parking. So, there you go. Now, on to ribs and sweet tea. When I returned to Bee's Barbecue around 9:15 a.m., parked cars and dusty pickup trucks lined the road, and a diverse local crowd in work boots, heels, and sneakers waited to order. Since the pandemic, Bee's has been takeaway only. 20 minutes later, I walked away with a haul, a half rack of ribs, a barbecue plate, and sweet tea that cost $18 and was enough to feed a family of hungry tailgaters. Despite the effort to secure the ribs, which were excellent, even better was the chopped barbecue, subtly smoky pork perfectly seasoned with punchy vinegar sauce. The flavor left no question as to how the hogs are cooked at Bee's, a rare outlier still using wood. Now, most of the places in eastern North Carolina have switched to gas now, and the sad part is a lot of people haven't noticed, lamented John Shelton Reed, a retired sociology professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and author of Holy Smoke, the big book on North Carolina barbecue. In an effort to educate the barbecue-eating public, Dr. Reed co-founded the Campaign for Real Barbecue to promote establishments that follow tradition, slow cooking over wood or wood coals. From Bee's, it's a winding hour-long drive southwest past cotton fields and pig farms to another old-timer, Grady's Barbecue in Dudley. Now, Steve, who's 90, and Gerald Grady, 81, opened the modest white cinder block restaurant in 1986, where yellowed newspaper clippings and award plaques now adorn the walls. Like Bee's, Grady's is cash only, but the handwritten menu includes more sides like rice and gravy, potato salad and green beans, and there's a dessert case with sweet potato pie, pineapple cake, and banana pudding. At a table inside, I tried a barbecue tray with a generous pile of peppery chopped pork, sides of slaw and black-eyed peas, still warm hush puppies, and Grady's Baby. That's a mix of lemonade and sweet tea. That's the one of the few remaining black-owned places in the state, said Dr. Reed. There used to be a lot more, but who knows how much longer they'll last. Last year, the Grady couple was among the inaugural class of inductees to the North Carolina Barbecue Hall of Fame, alongside two Eastern North Carolina brethren, the Skylight Inn and Sam Jones Barbecue. A meal at Skylight Inn. Well, pulling into the gravel lot of the Skylight Inn Barbecue in Aiden, with a population of just over 5,100, I parked beside a sheriff's cruiser. That's a sure sign of a top-notch barbecue joint, said Dr. Reed, from Pasquotank County, about 2 hours away. Now, Pete Jones opened this renowned barbecue destination in 1947, and today it's run by his son Bruce and a nephew Jeff. Atop the low-slung brick building sits a Capitol Dome replica, installed in the early 80s after the restaurant was named a Capital of Q by National Geographic. What continues to set this place apart is the long-standing tradition of chopping crisp skin into the barbecue, adding texture and crunch to every bite. The menu choices are few, either a sandwich or a tray of barbecue scooped into a red and white paper boat, topped with a thick slab of cornbread and a second boat of coleslaw. I chose the tray and a glass bottle of cheer wine and a cherry-flavored North Carolina soda with not a drop of alcohol, which made for an outstanding lunch. On the side, mac and cheese, black-eyed peas. Sam Jones opened the restaurant in Winterville in 2015. The pork sandwich there is slow-cooked, flecked with crisp bits of skin and lightly dressed in vinegar-based sauce. And for dinner, I sought out Sam Jones Barbecue. This was opened again in 1915 by the grandson of the Skylight Inn founder in nearby Winterville. That's a second location that opened in Raleigh in 2021. Beside a shopping center on a busy thoroughfare, it's a place that you'd expect to see a Bojangles or a Biscuitville, not a restaurant with a smoking pit and wood piles of Carolina oak in the parking lot. Inside, the restaurant with its high ceilings, smooth wooden booths, black and white family photos on the walls, and a soundtrack heavy on George Strait's 90s hits, offers various meats and sides. The mac and cheese and smoky black-eyed peas are standouts, as well as the craft beers and boozy cocktails, the inclusion of which caused quite a dust-up initially. My dad's a Baptist preacher, and he refused to come in the first 4 months I was open, Sam Jones said, chuckling. I could not try the cheer wine and bourbon slushy, which was delicious, but that's not the point of the place, which is the barbecue, as proven by the sublime sandwich on a soft potato roll named after Sam's granddad. The slow-cooked pork, flecked with crisp bits of skin, is done exactly as it's always been done at the Skylight Inn, lightly dressed in an apple vinegar, apple cider vinegar sauce with salt, pepper, and Texas Pete, red pepper, and hot sauce. Well, we have next ribs, sweet potato muffins, and a barbecue plate at Sam Jones Barbecue. That's the caption to a photo for this section. While I traveled in search of a dwindling number of singular old-school establishments, I left with the hope for the region's long-standing culinary traditions. Barbecue itself is defined by geography, Mr. Jones said, and what you call barbecue depends on what piece of dirt you're standing on. Well, as long as someone's still standing and cooking in eastern North Carolina, I'll keep coming back for more. How about that? Quite a journey there. Well, our food-focused travel itinerary is now going to go to Maine, where writer Danielle Dowling is going to take us slurping toward Nirvana on the Maine Oyster Trail. Now, as she explains, we'll be savoring all things fresh and briny while on a mission to visit all four of Maine's oyster regions in just one long weekend. Now, this particular article appeared in the July 4th edition of the New York Times. And here we go. And by the way, there's an interesting little tidbit that goes along with this article. We'll note that when we get there. Eat oysters only in months whose names contain the letter R. That old rule of thumb lingers, seemingly as fundamental as 30 days hath September. Yet there I was in late May, clearly not an R month, at Glidden Point Farm in Edgecombe, Maine, with three oysters, a knife, and a tour guide determined to teach me how to shuck them without losing a thumb. I wedged my knife into the hinge of the shellfish, then realized in horror that this was a living thing that I was about to savage. My guide, Althea Pendorthone, read my mind. "I like to thank the oyster," she said, to reassure me. Well, so after I pried the shell open and covered the meat in a tangy mignonette, I whispered, "Thank you, oyster," before gulping it down. A delicious quest. I had come to Maine to spend a long weekend navigating the Maine Oyster Trail, a collection of more than 80 restaurants, farms, and oyster-centered attractions. It seemed like a novel way to visit vacation land just as high season was starting. No lobsters, no lighthouses, no log cabins. Let the shellfish lead the way. Well, my competitive soul couldn't resist the trail's Oyster Passpoint program, which rewards participants with swag based on how many sites they visit. And my geeky heart was set on the beanie awarded for the visiting one business in which each of the trail's four regions, which stretch along the coast from south to north, the Maine beaches, the greater Portland and Casco Bay, the mid-coast and islands, and down east in Acadia. Because of the distance involved, there was no time to spare. I touched down at Portland International Jetport on a Thursday afternoon, hopped right in a rental car, and sped about 35 miles south to the seaside town of Cunquit. I made it to the Bricks and Brine, an alfresco restaurant with a patio and bar, just in time to sample the three oyster varieties on its chalkboard, and then visit the nearby Marginal Way, a must-see cliff walk, where I took a quick stroll to soak up some ocean views. The beaches region was on the books. And by the way, the town is Ogunquit. I had mispronounced it earlier, just so you know. Anyway, the next day, checking off the Mid-Coast region at Jolly Rogers' Raw Bar in Wakasset, I met Andy Rogers, a champion shucker and co-owner of the restaurant. Among the varieties he prepared for me was one of his favorites, the wet smacks from Maine Ocean Farms, where the shellfish are tumbled by wind and wave action in a process that Mr. Rogers likened to a gym for oysters. "One way to judge the fitness of an oyster before opening it is to bang two of them together," he said, demonstrating so that I could hear the sharp, solid sound they could make. "And when it comes to eating oysters only in months that have the letter R," he told me, "that rule was not relevant in cold water areas like Maine. Raw bars in a rowboat." The Maine Oyster Trail began in 2017 as a paper map directing tourists to a handful of raw bars and oyster farms. The state, synonymous with lobster, was aiming to reap the benefits of a decades-long effort to revive its oyster industry. And the trail, which is now fully online, was a way to market not only the oysters themselves, but oyster experiences, said Trixie Betts, the outreach and development specialist at the Maine Aquaculture Association. Farm tours appear often on the trail, which is how I ended up at Glidden Point on Friday afternoon. There, my oyster education continued with a history lesson and fun facts about the shellfish, the best one being that eastern oysters, the dominant species along the Atlantic coast, commonly start out as male and then after their first spawning season live out the rest of their lives as females. Well, at the farm, which sits on the Damariscotta River, cages on a docked boat brim not only with oysters but with green crabs skittering and brandishing their claws. The river also serves as a cold plunge for the sauna at the Glidden Point, which I discovered to my disappointment had closed for the season the weekend before my visit. I ended the day rowing in Belfast Harbor with Nicole Luttrell aboard a 19-and-a-half-foot dory named Saussure. Miss Luttrell, who started Dory Woman Rowing in 2021, offers sessions in a range of themes, whether you want to interact with wildlife or go on an excursion during the solstice under a full moon or at sunset. As we eased out to the mouth of the harbor, she gently corrected my off-kilter rhythm and awkward form. She also talked up Belfast, which she called the Mecca of rowing, where she relocated from Brooklyn in 1999. As she shared her plans to set up a sauna on the shore that would be available to locals as well as her clients after cold weather rowing sessions. It might seem odd and perhaps hazardous to row any time beyond the summer, but Miss Luttrell promised that it's very invigorating and safe. Besides, she says, Maine is a lovely in all four seasons. Shelter from the storm. Turns out Maine is much less lovely in the driving rain. On Saturday, a torrential downpour and a lost set of rental keys, keep that in mind, lost set of rental keys, soaked my plans to check off the Acadia region by visiting the Wakeg Neck Oyster Company in Sullivan and taking a boat tour of Frenchman Bay with the local oysterman, Graham Planter. Now, the bad luck also put the kibosh on a forest walk with the wilderness guide, Gene Christie. Because I couldn't check off Arcadia, I had also failed in my quest for the beanie, which would have come in handy on that chilly, damp day. I consoled myself with some retail therapy at a handful of cute shops in Rockland, which also has a few museums, including one dedicated to lighthouses and two to art. If you should ever need somewhere to shelter from the rain in Maine, check them out. Well, then I stopped at one of the city's trail locations, North Beacon Oyster. Now, getting a seat at the cozy restaurant can be hard, even in the off-season, so I felt a bit of luck returning when I found an open spot at the bar. I celebrated with a pairing of oysters from Unicorn Oyster Farm and a delightful mocktail called Unicorn Limeade. The next day in Portland, with some time to fill before my flight home, I headed to the shop, a market and raw bar. Its presence was so nondescript, a simple mural denouncing oysters in tall red letters. I almost drove right by it. But I'm glad I found it for two reasons. One, I was able to check off the Portland region, and two, the memory of its spicy raw scallop and melon salads and a half dozen of its juicy oysters endure. Now, the Aramonts will return soon enough, and when they do, I hope to complete my mission and earn that beanie. As a bonus, in the fall, oysters store up glycogen for the winter, making them all that much sweeter. Well, there you go. They had a good time talking about their shopping in Maine. And just as kind of a, shall I say, add-on, postscript, Danielle Downey never did find those lost keys to her rental car in Maine, if you were wondering. So we did a check, and that's the latest on the posted version of this story. So, Danielle, good luck on finding those keys. I hate to think what the fee was for that. Okay. Well, we're going to conclude our tasty tourist journey here by reading Timothy Taylor's story, My Oahu, Hike, Eat, Repeat. Now, as the headline reveals, we're going to Hawaii, where a frequent visitor shares his favorite walks and restaurants on the Hawaiian island. Now, this article appeared in the May 6, 2025 issue of the New York Times. Hawaii's Oahu Island is the kind of place where it seems you never meet a visitor who's been there just once. People visit, then they visit again. Pretty soon, Oahu has baked itself into your travel routines. In the process, those of us who end up loving it, a big number, considering total air arrivals at the Daniel K. Inouye International Airport in Honolulu reached 5.6 million people in 2023, have each become familiar with a slightly different version of the island. There are people for whom the North Shore and its big surf lunches from food trucks is the draw, or Waikiki for the shopping, or Pearl Harbor for sober reflections, or something else entirely. What my family and I return for repeatedly are the hikes and the stellar eats, for which Honolulu is one of the finest cities on earth. Here are my four favorite pairings: Kiowa Ridge and Bozu Restaurant. Now, the Kiowa Ridge Trail on the east coast of Oahu, the average hiker might make it to the top and back down in about an hour. The elevation change on the trail is moderate and the view is expansive. The Kiowa Ridge rises above the Wailea neighborhood of Kailua on the east coast of Oahu. You'll find the trailhead to Kalapalu Drive opposite the Mid-Pacific Country Club. It's not a long hike. You should make it to the top and back down in about an hour, and the elevation change is moderate, but it is steep and slippery in spots, so you may find yourself using the provided ropes. Now, along the way, you'll skirt the lip of the ridgeline, getting higher and higher views of Lanikai Beach and the Mokulua islets. At the end of your climb, you'll come to two colorfully graffitied World War II-era pillboxes on which social media influencers might be posed for selfies. Ignore them. Let the cleansing morning sunshine and sea breeze be your reward. Now, perhaps the meal following later that day will be something special. Get yourself to Bozu Japanese Restaurant in the unassuming McCulley Shopping Center strip mall just north of the Liwai Canal in Waikiki. With the typical clamor and crash of a busy izakaya, Bozu serves up everything from a yakitori to sushi to noodles. But you can't go wrong with the weekly specials. We ate briny whelk and Ark Cham sashimi, crispy chicken skin and ponzu with monkfish liver, pork jowl, and beef tongue off the Amayaki grill, plus two of the best tsukuni meatballs my in-house tsukuni meatball specialist has ever eaten. And by the way, it was about $70 for two for a very complete lunch. And Hawaiian lunches, I have to say, and dinners for that matter, are very special. I've been there and had these things, and don't let them freak you out, so to speak, because they are in the presentation alone is worth the visit. Let's go to Maikupu Lighthouse in Mud Hen Water for our next stop. Now, the Maikupu Lighthouse, or Makapu'u, let me change that pronunciation, Makapu'u Lighthouse on the southeast tip of Oahu, is said to have the largest lighthouse lens in the United States. Now, we hiked to the Makapu'u Lighthouse the next day. It's easier than the Kiowa Bridge, although it was likely to take you twice as long, and you'll climb a bit higher. But the trail is wide and paved, and you'll see people pushing kids in strollers and others in golf carts. The path winds from the parking lot just off the Kalana Noili Highway up and around the rocky eastern tip of Oahu to where the Makapu'u lookout is found. Now, the lighthouse is on the rocks below, apparently boasting the largest lens of any lighthouse in the United States. Here, the sea is deep cobalt blue, and it'll be worth the climb to have that Land's End sensation, the entire Pacific Ocean appearing to scroll out in front of you over the blip of the horizon. The Makapu'u Lighthouse Trail at sunrise, because the trail is wide and paved for suitable families with strollers and even for those using golf carts, so this is a wonderful outing for you. Now, the dinner along the Waialae Avenue is just westward on the north side of the H-1 highway that bisects Honolulu. Now, this neighborhood has a number of food destinations you don't want to miss, including brunch at the Cocoa Head Cafe and the Pipeline Bake Shop, where you can try malasadas, a Portuguese donut that is hugely popular in Hawaii, and their little glazed cake bombs. Now, we went to Mud Hen Water that evening, a quintessentially new-era aloha kind of place with Korean, Japanese, European, and local flavors all mingling. Do not allow yourself up to the table before trying the shatteringly crisp fried ulu breadfruit, the luau stuffed porchetta, and the chicken long rice croquettes with Japanese curry. All of this cost about $90 for two people. Now we head out to the Aiwa Loop and the Lilaha Bakery. Now, the lunch counter at the Lilaha Bakery is one of the author's favorite places to eat after hiking the Aiwa Loop. Now, dialing up the intensity, you might try the Aiwa Loop next, and at the very top of the Aiwa Heights, the loop is part of the Kiowa Haiu State Recreation Area. The trail itself is considered moderately hard, with a narrow track that rises and falls, tracing the line above the Halawa Valley. Now, this will take you deep into the lush vegetation of the central Oahu highlands, where the screech of birds in the brush and the wind through the long grasses will contribute to the feeling that you're very far from urban life. Where the thick tree cover briefly breaks, the lookout points and photo ops present magnificent views of Oahu's south shore. Now, the full loop will take about 3 hours, with roughly twice the elevation change of either the Makapu'u Lighthouse or the Lanakai Pillbox Hike. Depending on when you go, there may be much less foot traffic than the other two. Don't forget water. Consider hiking boots as well. And save this hike for a dry day, as parts of the loop trail will take you high above the jungle gorges and the track can be slippery. Afterwards, you may feel that you've brushed closer to a real version of Oahu than possible down in the city. This is a tourist feeling, but you can allow it under the circumstances. A great restaurant to match your temporary local status would be the lunch counter at Lilaha Bakery. Now, the famous spot opened in 1950 and would appear to have changed very little since then. The Cocoa Puffs and the Ponuchi Donuts are the stuff of Honolulu legend. Now, the savory menu is just as good, aloha dinner food, and at the top end of the quality scale, as a matter of fact. And there's a full slate of diner breakfasts, along with sides of spam and teriyaki chicken sticks. Then there's oxtail soup, salmon noodles, Japanese-style beef curry, plus a loco moco plate, a hamburger on rice with gravy, and a fried egg that I would personally fly a long distance to eat. And by the way, it's under $20 per person for lunch. And also, something else he wants to add, that hikers can expect to ascend more than 1,640 feet on this one. You step up your game one more notch, and you would take it from the Aiwa Loop to Kilauulu Ridge. Now, this walk is moderate to difficult. 4 hours is probably a good time to budget. Expect to climb over 1,640 feet, which is roughly the equivalent of about 200 flights of stairs. Follow Kilauulu Road all the way up to the Kalua Pilot place, at the top of which you'll find the well-marked trailhead. From the top of the valley, you're going to be hiking a steep switchback trail that eventually takes you to the top of Kulau Ridge and then leads to the Kulauulu Summit. Now, this is a popular hike and among the more difficult ones, so there will be lots of friendly people to compare notes on your progress, including those coming down who can report on how much climbing lies ahead. Always some encouragement, huh? Well, the Kulauulu Ridge is a gorgeous trail for the diversity of natural life that it reveals, and as you climb that first rise, you'll pass the Waloa Koa and Guava Stands, but at a certain altitude, they will give way to ironwood and cook pines. Some of the switchback portion of the trail is rocky, but by the time you get around 1,000 feet, where the pines begin, there will be thick, soft bed of needles on the trail, tamping down in sound and contributing to a feeling of a peaceful move. And so the author concludes saying that, for me at any rate, it's a pretty perfect place to go to Oahu. Makes my day complete. And I'm looking forward to my next visit, he writes. And that, my friends, brings us to the end of today's journey on Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed it and you'll be with us next time. I'm Mike Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and I remind you the content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. The number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.